Right. Well, I want to talk about both about is net zero achievable, but is net zero enough? And by that, I don't mean do we need to go beyond net zero. It would be great if we could, but I think we're going to be challenged enough to get to net zero. But actually, just to remind everyone that net zero implies considerable additional change to the climate, and it will be absolutely crucial that we also adapt. Just let me start by reminding us all that the climate is changing. And here is my favorite data set. It's my favorite data set because I think it's absolutely amazing that they have been recording the date of full flowering cherry blossom day in Kyoto since the early 800s. And it's been hovering around a similar date for hundreds and hundreds of years until the early 1900s, when it started getting earlier, and it is now 15 to 20 days earlier than it has been since the early 800s. So, clearly, a very interesting set of data, which tells you something very interesting about human behavior, I think. But this is perhaps a more useful way of looking at is the climate changing? And we can see since the early 1900s, we've seen a continuous rise in temperature. So that's that same data set. And I now just want to look at what it will look like if we are globally on a path to net zero and hopefully to below 2 degrees of warming, hopefully below that. But let's assume it's around 2 degrees of warming. So this is what the future could look like. This is one of a set of predictions from the Met Office. And what I want you to keep in your minds is that we've just had the hottest 10 years on record, but temperature doesn't start to stabilize till we get to net zero. And so the next 30 years will each be the hottest 10 years on record. So we have a lot of warming to come, even on a net zero pathway. And I think the last year really has felt like the world was trying to send leaders at COP26 a message with that appalling flooding in Germany and Belgium, which could so easily have happened here. That weather system could have been over us. At some point in the future, it's very likely that weather system will be over us and we will see devastation of that sort. But of course, we've seen devastation. Climate-induced devastation and extraordinary, unprecedented things happening all around the world. This just in 2021 alone, and the cost of the damage, the human cost, is of course increasing, but the insurance cost is also increasing. And you know, this data suggests that climate-related events have increased in terms of financial impact from something like $357 billion in the decade of the 1980s to something like 1.5 trillion in the last decade. So that's going to go on rising at least that pace, if not more, over the next 30 years. So what are we doing about it in the UK? Well, we have made a commitment to get to net zero by 2050. And we made that in 2019. So here's our starting point in 2019. And we can see that the only sector that looks as if it has any chance of getting to net zero at the moment is the power sector. And that dramatic reduction in power sector emissions has come from taking coal off the system. So we now got to replace that coal and grow the power system with lots of renewables. But we've got some really problematic areas like transport and buildings, which run through the center of that plot, the blue and the orange lines. And we've got some other problems like aviation, which is the bluey grey line at the bottom, which is increasing and just crossing over the green line at the end. So a lot more to do across every sector of the economy. And this in the Climate Change Committee's modeling shows the types of things we need to be doing and the sort of contribution they could make to us reaching net zero in 2050. So the purpley colors are reduced demand and improved efficiency, including resource efficiency. The orange, red and yellow are take up of new technologies, in particular, a huge role for electrification, but also hydrogen and carbon capture. The blue is the expansion of the zero carbon electricity system to accommodate all of that electrification. And that still leaves us with some emissions. So we're going to need some offsetting, which is why, of course, it's net zero. Hopefully, as much of that offsetting as possible can be through nature-based solutions, but we may need some direct air capture or other sorts of removal of carbon from the atmosphere. Underlying that are huge changes to the way we use energy. So in the core scenario that the Climate Change Committee used for the sixth carbon budget, electricity use more than doubles. So electricity use today is about 300 terawatt hours. By 2050, that's gone up to 720 terawatt hours. So almost 2.5 times as big. In some scenarios, it goes up to 3 times as much electricity. So we need to see a huge expansion in our electricity system. But it's also, simplistically, a very dramatic change in the way we use energy. So today we use about 2000 terawatt hours of energy in total. And actually electricity is only about 15% of that. The rest is oil and gas. In 2050, we will be much, much more efficient because, for example, an electric vehicle is something like 4 times more efficient than an internal combustion engine. So our energy use in total drops quite dramatically, but most of it will be electricity. So we'll be essentially an electric nation. And that brings with it issues of resilience. Our electricity system is going to have to be hugely resilient to things like the changing climate, because when the electricity goes off, then everything will stop. The scale of the change, as we've just heard, is very significant indeed. And I think this is my list that just reminds us the sort of scale of things we have to do in the next 30 years. We've got to more than double the size of the electricity system. We've got to grow offshore wind from 10 gigawatts today to nearly 100 gigawatts by 2050. We've got to support that by transforming the grid, because we could be into 80%+ variable renewables by 2050. So the grid's got to grow in scale, but it's got to grow enormously in terms of flexibility and storage and resilience. We've got to grow a green hydrogen industry, or a green and blue hydrogen industry, essentially from nothing today to something approaching the size of our current electricity system. We've got to get carbon capture and storage up and running. We've got 29 million buildings that need to be converted to low carbon heat. We've got to get to something of the order of 35 million zero carbon vehicles and the infrastructure to support them. We've got to get afforestation and woodland creation from below 10,000 hectares per annum to around 50,000 hectares per annum, increasing our woodland and forest cover by about 4% to about 18%, still one of the lowest in Europe, if not the lowest in Europe. That will need major changes to agriculture and significant changes to our diets. So we've done things of that scale in 30 years before. It's not really clear that we've ever managed to do all of those things at once, but all of those things are doable. With the right commitment, none of those things are impossible. So it is doable, but it's going to take a lot of commitment and a lot of mobilization of the population. And that's, I think, one of the most challenging bits. If we look at where we've come to since the Climate Change Act was passed, then 83% of the emissions reduction since the Climate Change Act was passed have come essentially from things like decarbonizing industry and, in a major chunk, from decarbonizing the electricity system. So things that haven't involved you or I having to do anything different at all. You switch the light switch, the same electricity, the same lights come on. We haven't actually had to engage with that in any real way. As we move forward to 2050, we find that something like 60% of what we need to do actually needs people to be engaged with it. people in their homes, in their choices of car, in their behaviors need to be making different decisions. So a significant majority of what we need to do going forward needs the public to be fully engaged. But there is some good news as well, which is that it's getting cheaper. I think Nick Stern said it might cost us 3% to decarbonize in the CCC's first work that we did for the Climate Change Act back in 2008. We thought it was going to cost between 1% and 2% to get to an 80% reduction. The core scenario now suggests that we should get to, we might get to 100% reduction at 0.5% of GDP, 0.5% of GDP. And indeed, some of the other analysis that's been done in places like Oxford and others is now suggesting actually that we will increase GDP by decarbonising the UK economy. So actually, the amazing reductions in costs we've seen in solar, in batteries, in offshore wind are actually driving the costs of the transition down and actually driving the economic opportunities from the transition up. So actually, it looks like an entirely economically rational thing to do, even without taking into account the costs of the climate damage. So it's kind of win-win-win. But let me just get back to that point that net zero is not enough. Actually, just sorting out the emissions doesn't keep people safe. Climate risk is a combination of the hazard caused by the emissions, how exposed people are to it, and how vulnerable people are to it. And adaptation is about reducing exposure and vulnerability. So here we are, it's been getting very, very much hotter. And down in the southeast, maximum temperatures are rising at almost a degree per decade. We're going to see growing water deficits, again, particularly down in the southeast. We're growing, even on a 2-degree path, we're going to see more people at risk of flooding. We're already seeing in Europe the impact of climate change on our forests. In Germany, they're seeing huge impacts of winter rainfall, summer drought and heat, new pests and diseases already hitting most of their common trees. And this is the kind of issue that we are going to be seeing from climate change. And by the 2050s, quite a lot more climate change, as I showed in those earlier charts, is going to happen. So another 0.6 or so degrees of temperature rise is likely. We're going to see less summer rainfall. We're going to see more winter rainfall. We're going to see more of that rainfall coming as bursts of very, very heavy rainfall, which cause surface water flooding. We're going to see our heatwave summers like 2018 will just be a normal summer by the middle of the century, and the sea level is going to be continuing to rise. So we've got to be prepared for all of that, even if we are on, as we all hope we will be, the net zero pathway. So we've got to start making sure that when we convert buildings and build new homes, they are safe for people to live in. Unlike this office block converted to flats, where in the summer of 2018, in the unshaded rooms, internal temperatures reached almost 50 degrees. Somebody with asthma, an elderly person not very mobile, a baby in a cot, could have been killed by those sorts of internal temperatures. It's not acceptable that we are providing homes for people that are not safe in the context of our changing climate. We've got to think about how we support nature to adapt to the climate. And part of that is thinking about what trees do we plant in this forest and woodland, in these forests and woodlands we need to generate. And you can see the dramatic change in the suitability for growing beech trees. So around me in Cambridge, we shouldn't be planting beech hedges in our gardens, because by 2050, they are really going to struggle. And similarly, Sitka spruce. So lots of these lovely trees will be moving up to Scotland, and we should be thinking about some more Mediterranean planting for the long term in regions in the southeast. Adaptation can work. This is how we could transform the picture in terms of water availability. If we move from 140 litres per person per day water consumption down to about 90, and if industry makes the same kinds of savings, and if we address all of the leaks in our water system, then we could get to 2050 with very similar water availability that we have today. So adaptation action can really make a difference. And we need to be building new homes in areas like Cambridgeshire, where I am, where we are in a water-stressed area. We need to be building them to much, much higher water efficiency standards so that we don't end up with the picture on the left, we end up with the picture on the right. And we need to stop building we need to stop locking in problems for the future, for example, by building in areas of high flood risk. And this just shows you in the last 25 years or so, quite how much building work has continued to go on in areas we know are at increasing flood risk in the future. And finally, we need to recognise that climate change disproportionately impacts the vulnerable. So if we think about coastal communities, we have many areas of poverty around our coastal communities, and also many elderly people live in our coastal communities. So these are people who suffer from vulnerability inequality in terms of both age and low income. If they're in coastal communities, then of course they're particularly susceptible to coastal flooding. They're, as we've said, they have greater vulnerability. They're more likely to live in uninsured homes. And so when that climate hazard impacts them, they suffer disproportionate losses. So uninsured homes, so they lose assets. If they're having to do all their own cleaning up, they may have to take more time off work. We know from data from the 2007 floods that people from low-income groups are 8 times more likely to report mental health problems as a result of flooding. So all of these things mean that vulnerable groups suffer disproportionately in terms of climate change and therefore become more vulnerable. So it becomes a negative spiral. And we see that in the UK. And of course, we see that internationally as well, with the countries that are already having to deal with significant climate change impacts. So it's absolutely crucial that when we think about dealing with climate change, we think about dealing with inequality at the same time. And one of the things we critically need to do is to make sure we integrate, or rather we test, just about all policy that we produce in the UK, both against does it stack up with net zero, but also does it include consideration of adaptation. And we've had quite a lot of relevant announcements that deal with, for example, net zero, things like the Green Homes Grant, where no mention was made of preparing our homes for the future. So you can be doing all sorts of work on the inside of your home to put in the insulation and the heat pump, but while you're doing that, that's the time to be putting in the shading and making sure that home is livable in even hotter summers. But the piece of policy only dealt with the reducing emissions. We've had the net zero strategy now. That does at least mention adaptation, but it isn't particularly well integrated. And of course, we have some policy that's mainly focused on adaptation, things like the flood and coastal erosion risk management strategy. But we're still seeing far too much policy which doesn't take both net zero and adaptation into account. And we really need to get that thinking across government to make sure that both these aspects of reducing climate change impacts are taken into account in all of the policy that we produce. So thank you very much for listening to you. I just leave you with a quote from Greta Thunberg, which is this brilliant one about cathedral thinking, which is we've got to get started. We don't have to know exactly all of the technologies that we might be able to use in 2050. We know enough about it in order to get going. And it is absolutely urgent that we make really significant strides over the next 10 years. Thank you very much.